A 300-pound gorilla caused me to look seriously at where I see myself as a part of the creation story in Genesis. A 300-pound gorilla made me examine my role on this planet. He asked me to consider if I'm a taker, someone who believes that the world was made for me, or a leaver, someone who believes that I was made for this world. A 300-pound gorilla made me see how the world eats, determines how the world is used. That 300-pound gorilla now sits in my grocery cart every time I go to the store. Let me introduce you to Ishmael, the 300-pound gorilla in Daniel Quinn's book by the same title. The story begins with a man challenged by an ad that he comes across in the classified, simply stating, "Teacher seeks pupil. Must have an earnest desire to save the world. Apply in person." He goes to the address listed in the ad, and he's shocked to find an enormous and rather gamey-smelling gorilla sitting in a cage in a dark but empty office. Nervously, the man approaches the gorilla, and surprisingly, the two begin to converse. We learn quickly that Ishmael is a teacher, or a prophet of sorts, that challenges not just his new student, but we as the reader, to reexamine our place on this planet and how we choose to live within it. Ishmael opened my eyes to reexamine my place in many of the creation stories we share in our culture. And usually these stories begin with tales of darkness, the creation of light and air, water and earth, and then plants and animals, and lastly, humans. Then it seems in most stories, creation stops. One gets the feeling that perhaps now that humans have arrived, the interesting things can begin. In the Bible, the creation story, the first 26 lines of Genesis tells us of the creation of the earth. Once man arrives, the next 2,000 pages are focused on humans and our messy lives and difficulties and how we're intended to live in this world. After that first 26 lines of the story, there's little mention of other forms of life, of plants or animals and their role in this world. Ishmael brings our attention to this very fact, and then he asks, did the gods stop creating after humans arrived? It seems to appear that once people arrived, there was nothing new to create, or at least nothing better to create. These stories seem to enforce that we are the pinnacle of creation. Be honest. How do you see yourself in these stories? Is humankind the focus of these stories? Was the world, in fact, made for us? Are we the rulers of the world now that we're here? Our culture surely seems to teach us that we are. Our culture tells us that we are the smartest and really the only intelligent creatures on the earth. When I last visited the Field Museum of History in Chicago, I walked through displays that told the story of our early ancestors through the use of artifacts and recreations. The titles of the displays had words like hunters and gatherers. Soon the titles changed to farmers and agriculturalists. As I walked farther along, the displays showed how societies had formed and skills had developed, and the words used to describe humans changed dramatically. I was stunned to see the words rulers and kings. As we have developed over the years, have we become the gods? Our culture whispers in our ears that we really are the ones in control here. In essence, I believe most people would say we are the rulers of the earth. And certainly that's easy to accept. So the question must be asked, who or what do we really trust to provide for us? Is it ourselves, or a god, or the earth? I began to examine what I thought about this myself. In the Midwest, where weather controls our daily lives, the weather can change quickly, providing warmth and food one day and cold and barrenness the next. Without planning and without thinking ahead, we would literally perish. Ishmael, that 300-pound gorilla, reveals how our agricultural society developed and how becoming agriculturalists changed how we saw our place on this earth. We began to try to take control of the earth and our environment and wrestle it away from the gods. Ishmael examines how our culture has taught us to become takers, who developed a mistaken understanding that the world was created for us. Our culture has taught us to believe that we're the centerpiece of the creation story, and it's now our task to control the earth. And control it we do. We were given this Garden of Eden, a place of bounty and plenty, but eventually, as we developed, we didn't want to have to seek our food. We wanted our food to be there when we wanted it. So we developed into an agricultural society, which isn't bad in itself. But then we began to control who owned the land and who got the food. Ishmael points out by expanding food production, we expand populations. And those expanding populations create a need for more food production. We continue to put nature out of balance, and yet we can't seem to stop ourselves. We are now in a place where we believe if we can control the earth even more, we could solve our problems. Yet trying to control the environment, trying to play the gods, has placed everything out of balance. Ishmael calls this a taker society, a society that believes that the earth is created for humans to do with as they please, to rule just like the kings in the exhibits at the Field Museum. But it's not working, is it? As Unitarian Universalists, our seventh guiding principle is recognizing and honoring the interconnected web of life in which we are all a part. How we live, plant, and eat affects everything else around us. Ishmael shares about people who have lived their lives as leavers. These are cultures who have understood that they were made for the earth and that they must live in relationship with the earth and in partnership. And we find that most indigenous people around the world fall into this category. And sadly, those are the groups that most of us takers are destroying. Like I said, agriculture is not a bad thing when it's done in balance and respect to the land. But it's a terrible thing when it consumes and destroys the land and the people who live around it. When I was in seminary, I went on a social justice trip to Guatemala, and we saw acres and acres of mountainside farmland stripped of all their natural vegetation and planted with rows and rows of vegetables meant for market. The land was owned by only a small fraction of wealthy Guatemalans who made millions by selling their crops to American companies. The people actually doing the labor in the fields traveled by bus or walked for miles to get to work, working in the fields for hours to grow cabbages and melons that were not sold in their local markets at all, but transported in trucks and cargo shipments to mega grocery stores in the United States. Or just the other day, any one of us could have picked up a melon from Guatemala for $2.99 at the grocery store. I suspect the Guatemalan worker in the field did not even make that much an hour. I suspected that he or she lived in one of the many corn-stocked walled houses and shacks that I saw tucked under bridges and viaducts with no running water. How does this make sense? And how responsible are we for this imbalance, this injustice, when we purchase that melon? Barbara Kingsolver, a well-known novelist, took on an interesting challenge. Coming from a farming family, she grew up growing and canning a lot of her own foods. She clearly understood the idea of letting the bounty of the earth grow and blossom in her garden. She challenged her family to live for one whole year on what they grew and what they could obtain locally from farmers in her area. And she documented it in her book, Animal, Vegetable, Mineral, Miracle. She proclaimed that eaters, and I guess that means every one of us here in this room, need to realize that how we eat determines how the world is used. I felt the weight of Ishmael on my back as I read this. How I eat determines how the world is used. I heard Ishmael whispering, "Will you be a leaver or a taker?" I have to confess that last year in the frigid cold of January, there was a surprising abundance of blackberries at my grocery store. They were huge, plump, and juicy in their tiny little plastic purses. They were stacked on top of one another in the produce department, and they were only $1.99. I bought them as often as I could. And then one day, I noticed in tiny print at the bottom of the label, it said that they were grown in Chile. This wasn't Chile, California, or Chile, Florida, places that are thousands of miles away from my home in Wisconsin. This was Chile, South America, tens of thousands of miles away from my home. What was the carbon footprint of that tiny purse of plump berries? What was I contributing to as I put them on my salad in Appleton, Wisconsin? Was I being a leaver or a taker? We have the gift of free will, of making our own choices. And I believe this allows us to be co-creators alongside the universe in this journey of life. I also believe that we must be held accountable for the co-creating that we do. Ishmael is beginning to weigh heavily upon my back. What I purchase and my choices will continue to determine how the earth is used. I see now that I have to wake up and at least be aware. And having this knowledge can be a painful thing. I admit it, I really like to eat good food. So does this mean in the dead of winter we should eat only roots and dried berries? The more we know, the more we can make changes. And I've begun to see a shift in many restaurants that are focusing on seasonal menus, ones that change as the seasons change, offering the bounty of the seasons. Sounds like a great idea, especially throughout most of the year, but what might one expect in the dead of winter in Wisconsin? Amazingly enough, I've seen menus contain just as many delights. Locally raised roast of lamb with baked Yukon Gold potatoes and multicolored beet salads, pasta with pesto and sun-dried tomatoes, and grated local cheeses. Mouth water just sort of thinking about it. Our own Jay and Kelly Barnes have worked hard to create their new business that serves locally grown meats, cheeses, and produce. By being creative and respectful of the carbon footprint of the food that they create, they're making a difference in how our land is used and holding up the local economy while they do it. In her book, Barbara Kingsolver offers similar menus as she goes through the seasons, each one more mouth-watering than the rest. But she's honest about this endeavor of hers. Yes, she is a wealthy, well-known author. Yes, she has a family farm in Virginia where she has more than enough land and money to live and eat in this manner. But what about those of us who live in metropolitan areas, in apartments, or who are on tight budgets? How can someone like me participate in the spirit of being a leaver and not a taker, of determining how the earth is used to provide me with food? King Solver offers simple ideas for container gardening or community gardening if we don't have access to land, or buying into farm co-ops and getting shares from local farmers. She invites us to support our local farmers markets when we're able and to read the labels of the produce we purchase so we know where our food is coming from. Now I know for many of us here, I'm preaching to the choir. A lot of you do this work. You work in your own gardens. You belong to community gardens. You have farm shares. I see many of you Saturday mornings at the farmers market, and I'm so excited how that market has grown over the years. It's really expanded in the last few years. It signifies to me a change in thinking. And yet, I think of a dear, dear friend of mine who struggles with poverty and providing food for her family, and how that enormous bag of processed cereal at the grocery store that costs her $2.99 fills the bellies of her three children more and longer than spending the same amount at the farmer's market on a few vegetables and fruits. This is not right. And I'm not sure if I have any major answers for that one. But it seems to me that being aware is a beginning. Each little step, each little honoring of the earth and this community of local food producers is a way to try and begin. The more we pay attention, the more we see the effects. Barbara Kingsolver cautions us that when we get what we want, such as blackberries in January, it comes at a price. Not just the $1.99 I gave the cashier, but it affects the untallied debts that will be paid by our children and future generations at the cost of animal extinctions, economic unraveling, and global climate change. The manner in which we are allowed to steal from future generations in our desire to have what we want, when we want it, is spiritually bankrupt. There are moral consequences to our food choices and global consequences of how it's produced and transported. Ishmael employs his students that we can't change the way things have been done in the food industry by changing laws. We must change people's minds. When people change their minds, they change their actions. And changed actions force corporations to change their policies. He employs his students to teach others what he's taught him, as we can't go on treating the world as if it were a piece of human property, but instead that we are property of this world. The Lever lifestyle isn't about going back to being hunters and gatherers. It's about honoring and allowing the rest of the world, other animals, plants, and people, to live equally. Our task is not to reach back to the ways of the past, but to reach forward with compassion and understanding that we are only a piece of the creation story, not the completion. Can you feel Ishmael whispering to you? I know I can. But it doesn't have to be a march of guilt every time you go to the grocery store either. Like Ishmael employed his student, like Barbara Kingsolver challenges her readers, we can change how we think, even if it is just one little thing. That's a beginning. That's a step in the right direction. Being aware of where our food comes from is huge. Selecting local food producers and food that's seasonal are small but important shifts. Will that change the world and how it's used to feed us? Not in any grand or immediate sweeping way, but if more and more people begin to be aware, then we can eventually change our behaviors. Look at how recycling has become a habit in our homes and restaurants and business places. That was a new way of seeing how we handled waste. and it changed our behaviors. If we change our behaviors, we can change how industry treats this world, and thus how the world is used. By making mindful and responsible food choices in consistent ways, maybe we will all be able to become a world of levers instead of takers. May it be so.